Welcome back, everybody. Today, we will upgrade the math a little bit. We will use some of the techniques that we've developed earlier to go further. But first, let me remind you, we defined a curvature map R, and it takes in three tangent vectors and outputs a tangent vector, namely this one. And in particular, this part is called the curvature map. The curvature map obeys the Bianchi identities. And remember, the Bianchi identities are structural. These are equations that may look like they are non-trivial equations for the curvature and or the torsion, something like equations of motion, but they're not. They just have to be obeyed. It's part of the structure of the entire framework. So the first Bianchi identity that the curvature map obeys is this one. And you see it's rather tedious. On the right-hand side, it has the torsion. This is the torsion map. But in general relativity, torsion is absent. And so the right-hand side actually simplifies to zero. The second Bianchi identity also involves the Riemann curvature map and also the torsion. Again, one of the terms would be absent if there is no torsion. These are fairly abstract equations. Let us look at what they are explicitly in a chart. So now we make two choices here. The first choice is that we choose a coordinate system. Let's call it the coordinate system of the x. And secondly, we make the choice that we use for our tangent and cotangent spaces the bases that come along with our choice of coordinates. We don't have to. And later in this lecture, we will free ourselves from that need. But for the moment, we will use that basis, these two bases for the tangent and cotangent spaces that come along with the choice of basis of coordinate system. In this case, one can show that the first Bianchi identity, this big thing here, reduces to something very simple. Here we have the cyclic sum of these terms. And on the right-hand side, we have zero. Cyclic means that you have, if there are three arguments, cyclic sum means that it's the sum of three terms. One term where xi is the first, eta is the second, and mu is the third. And the next term will have nu flipped over here. So nu is the first entry, then the xi, then the eta. And the third term in the sum will have that the eta is now the first, and then the nu, and then the xi. So the first Bianchi identity, if we choose a coordinate system and the coordinate basis, takes this form. It means that the cyclic sum of these entries of the Riemann curvature tensor is zero. And the second Bianchi identity, which involves a covariant derivative, as you can see here, in the absence of torsion, we consider the case of with the absence of torsion. The second Bianchi identity takes this form. This one is very useful in practice, as we will later see. But that one is crucial. And it led Einstein to find the equations of motion, as we will see later. Other useful properties that can be proven for the Riemann curvature tensor are these. Riemann curvature tensor has an anti-symmetry in the last two indices. If I switch k and l to l and k, then I pick up a minus sign. And the same is true for the first two indices. If I lower the first index down, then I get anti-symmetry here, and I get anti-symmetry there. Furthermore, there is symmetry in the exchange of the first pair of indices and the second pair of indices. So if I move the ij over here and the kl over there, I get symmetry. This, by the way, is an interesting property that has some interesting implications. Namely, what that means is that if you consider these two indices as one combined index, like if each one of them runs from 0 to 3, we have four options for each one of these indices, so the combined index runs from 1 to 16, there are 16 possibilities, 4 squared, and the same here, so we can view the Riemann curvature tensor, therefore, as having one index that runs up to 16, and another index that runs up to 16, and it is symmetric in the interchange of the two. It also has real entries, so it's symmetric, it's a self-adjoint matrix, and you can diagonalize it. And so what it is, it gives us a metric on the space of two tensors, right? Entisymmetric two tensors. It gives us a metric on the space of entisymmetric two tensors, because this map maps antisymmetric two tensors into antisymmetric two tensors. However, it really is only positive definite in the case of the Riemannian signature. In the case of the Lorentzian signature, it is not. And therefore, for example, the spectral theorem will not hold in the case of Lorentzian manifolds, but for Riemannian, it will. Now let us use these properties of the Riemann curvature tensor to derive two more tensors from it. First, there is the Ricci tensor. The Ricci tensor is derived by taking the Riemann curvature tensor and contracting its first index with its third index. You may wonder, why the third? Why would I not contract with the second one or with the fourth? Well, what if I contracted instead with the fourth? I'd pick up a minus sign, because we have anti-symmetry in those two guys, right? So that makes no difference, really, whether I do it with the third or the fourth. What if I contracted with the second one?
Zero,
because it's anti-symmetric, right? So it's really the only way you can get a non-trivial two tensor out of the Riemann curvature tensor. So this is the Ricci tensor, and the Ricci tensor doesn't know everything about curvature. The Riemann curvature tensor does, by definition, but the Ricci tensor is a contraction of it. We form the sum of certain terms. And when I tell you 8, you don't know whether that came from 7 plus 1 or 6 plus 2 or something like that, right? And so similarly, here, this tensor has less information about the curvature than the full Riemann curvature tensor. We express that by saying that this tensor knows only the Ricci curvature. So we distinguish between so-called Ricci curvature, which is the information that this tensor contains, and the remaining curvature that this tensor has no idea about. And that remaining curvature is called wild curvature. Later in this course, we will find out exactly what that is. For example, gravitational waves are wild curvature. And when you have matter and that curved space, for example, the metric inside the Earth is given by Ricci curvature. Then we can further contract the Ricci tensor to obtain a scalar, simply by contracting its two indices. And there's no choice in that. With these two definitions, one can then prove on the basis of the second Bianchi identity, remember, that's the one that involved a covariant derivative, this one, which in the absence of torsion and in a coordinate system with a coordinate basis looks like this. This equation, as I said, was to be very important for Einstein. This equation translates for these two tensors, I mean that's a scalar, that's a tensor, into that equation. So the second Bianchi identity says that the curvature always obeys that equation, no matter what. It has nothing to do with the Einstein equation. It's because we haven't got it yet, right? We haven't written down any dynamics yet. And nevertheless, it's a structural thing that the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar, these two quantities, obey that equation here. Namely, that their covariant derivative, that the covariant derivative of that combination here is equal to zero. It's a little exercise for you to check that this really follows from the second Bianchi identity. Not hard to prove. Since this combination here of those two tensors has this peculiar property that its covariant derivative is vanishing, it has been given a special name, and also because Einstein used it so much, this thing is called the Einstein tensor. So the Einstein tensor is just like the Ricci tensor, something that only knows about Ricci curvature because it's made out of the Ricci tensor. It doesn't know about Weyl curvature. And it is just like the Ricci tensor, a two tensor. You can lower and raise the indices whichever way you want. So you can write it as a 0-2 tensor or as a 2-0 tensor or as a 1-1 tensor. So what we see here is that the so-called Einstein tensor, this combination here, has the property that its covariant derivative vanishes. The covariant derivative contracted here, right? It doesn't mean that in any direction it's vanishing. You have to contract it with a k. Okay, with these preparations now, let us reconsider where we are in this course. We discussed how the shape of a manifold can be described. There is the fact that when there is curvature, then, or when the shape is non-trivial, let's say, because curvature is a technical term and shape just the idea of a non-trivial manifold, we know that when the shape is non-trivial, then Pythagoras' theorem will not hold. And by how much it is violated can be used to quantify how much the shape is curved. Also, the sum of the angles in a triangle is not going to be 180 degrees. And correspondingly, these deficiency angles can be used to describe curvature. We also describe that when the shape is non-trivial, then distance relationships are non-trivial. That is really ultimately Pythagoras' theorem being violated. And on that basis, if we look at the infinitesimal version of Pythagoras' theorem being violated, we arrived at the idea of describing the shape of a manifold through a metric, because the metric tells us what infinitesimal distances are. And if you think about how you describe the distance between two events, using the metric, it is really that generalization of Pythagoras for arbitrarily small distances. It's the infinitesimal Pythagoras repaired for the presence of curvature. So we described shape through a metric. And then we said, okay, let's put that aside for a moment. We can also describe shape differently. And the new idea was to describe the non-triviality of shape, so the non-triviality of parallel transport. Parallel transport around the parallelogram may bring back the vector to the same place, namely if there's no torsion. It may bring it back to the same place, but still rotate it. So then we can ask, how much has the vector rotated? By the more it has rotated, the more curvature there is. And mathematically, we described parallel transport through the affine connection. And we then also defined the notions of torsion and curvature in terms of the affine connection. Now let's get back to where we started. We had described already the non-trivial shape of a manifold using the metric. If we do that, how can we then describe the same manifold using an affine connection? There ought to exist a way to calculate the affine connection once we know once we've specified the manifold through a metric. So how does the metric specify the affine connection? Now the central idea that we will use for relating the two ways of describing space-time, space-time's non-trivial shape, the central idea is that parallel transport, if it is really to be parallel transport and nothing else, parallel transport should preserve angles and should preserve lengths. You see, this is pointing in some direction now, and if I'm to parallel transport that direction while I'm moving around, then the notion of parallel transport is to mean that certainly I'm not changing the length of the vector while I travel, but also it's not changing direction, right? So in particular, if I have two vectors that I'm parallel transporting, then if I'm truly parallel transporting both vectors, the angle between them should stay the same. And what that means is that lengths and angles, as calculated by the metric, should stay the same under parallel transport. So let us concretely consider some path in the manifold, some path gamma in the manifold. So it takes us from some parameter t, which you can think of as the eigentime of an observer, on a trip through the manifold. So let's consider a path gamma and two vector fields, eta and nu. And let's assume that these vector fields are chosen such that they are autoparallel for that path, which means that if you evaluate the vector field eta along that path, then you find that the vector field obeys the autoparallel equation, which said that the vector field at one point and the vector field at another point of the path are obtained from each other by parallel transport. And the same, we assume, is true for a vector field nu. So we have two vector fields that are parallel transported along a path gamma. So then, these two conditions hold. This is the autoparallel equation for the vector field eta, and that's the autoparallel equation for the vector field nu. So the covariant derivative of the vector field eta in the direction tangent to the path is to vanish, and nu is autoparallel to the path if its covariant derivative in the direction of the tangent is vanishing as well. So then what we require is this. If we take the vector field eta and the vector field nu, evaluate them at a point of the path, and then calculate the inner product using the metric at the point of the path, then intuitively what we get is the length of one vector times the length of another vector times the cosine of the angle. It's not so trivial when the signature is indefinite, but that's the idea. The inner product between two vectors captures length and angle, and these should be preserved under parallel transport. So we want that this, the inner product between two vectors should remain the same if the two vectors are being parallel transported. So we want that this number, this scalar number, differentiated with respect to the time parameter along the path, is vanishing. So this inner product does not change as we parallel transport our vectors. Now you can think of the d by dt as d by dx mu by dt, chain rule. So you can also differentiate with respect to the d by dx mu along the path, and then dx mu by dt. Or you can remember what the geometric definition of tangent vectors is to see that the fact or the requirement that this expression vanishes explicitly means, in terms of the coefficients, that what vanishes is gamma dot A and then the covariant derivative of the metric contracting the eta and the nu vectors, right? So this is obviously that, the inner product between the eta and the nu field using the metric. And the d by dt is like dx by dt, right? Because that's the tangent vector, dx by dt. And then d by dx, dx by dt, that's right. So this is the d by dx covariant derivative, and this is dx by dt. So we have to covariantly differentiate this contraction here. And we remember that the covariant derivative is a derivation. So what we have to do is differentiate each of these three terms individually. So we carry forward the gamma dot A, and then we have the covariant derivative applied to the first factor among those three, multiplying, carried forward the eta and the nu, plus carrying forward the g, covariantly differentiating the eta, carrying forward the new, and in the third term, we are covalently differentiating the new. Now, these two terms vanish because of the parallel transport equation. Right? Because this is exactly the change of the vector field eta in the direction of our path. And so that is vanishing, and the same is true here. So those two terms are absent. We want that the whole thing vanishes. And so what we need is that this term vanishes. Because this is to be true for all vectors, for all paths. So what that means is that for the affine connection, for an affine connection to describe the same manifold as the metric does, for we say for the affine connection to be compatible with the metric, we must have that the covariant derivative of the metric is vanishing everywhere and in all directions. So the covariant derivative of G is vanishing in all directions. Now, how do we know that we can always find an affine connection that will do it? I mean, it's conceivable that maybe with a non-trivial metric, we describe some manifold that has a shape that simply cannot be captured by the affine connection, by any affine connection. That's not happening. The fundamental theorem of Riemannian and pseudo-Riemannian geometry, pseudo-Riemannian referring to the case of an indefinite metric, such as the Lorentzian metric, the fundamental theorem of pseudo and Riemannian geometry says that for every pseudo or Riemannian manifold defined through a differentiable manifold and the addition of a metric, there always exists an affine connection, in fact it is unique, such that it is without torsion and compatible with G, so obeys this. And that unique connection is called the Levi-Civita connection. More generally, if we do like torsion, then the statement is that for all for all Riemannian or pseudo-Riemannian manifolds, and for all given tensor fields tau, I mean, you choose a manifold with a metric and you choose a tensor field that is anti-symmetric in a two lower indices. So just like a torsion field, it has one contravariant index and two covariant indices and is anti-symmetric in the two covariant ones. For any such choice of a Riemannian or Lorentzian manifold with a tensor field like that, there exists a affine connection that preserves the metric and whose torsion is given by tau. How does this look like explicitly? So we have that the covariant derivative of the metric is vanishing. Remember, that's the absolute covariant derivative, where we are not spelling out what the which vector psi, in which direction we are differentiating. Concretely, in coordinates, and when I say in coordinates, I'm using the usual language, but I hope you can read this now as saying more than the words directly express. When we say, now we're going to write this in coordinates, what we mean is we choose a coordinate system and we choose the basis d by dxi and dxj as the basis of the tangent and cotangent spaces, the basis that come with the coordinate system. If we do that, then this calculation will follow. Today, we will free ourselves from that requirement and we will see a generalization of this at the very end of the lecture. So, if we choose that, then this equation translates concretely into this one, right? It's because we have that the covariant derivative, if you remember, it acts on the coefficient functions by ordinary differentiation, that's this, and it acts on the covariant basis vectors using the Christoffel symbols. That's why we get all of those terms. It's a Leibniz rule case, right? The G itself has a coefficient function, and it has two basis vectors in it because it's a two tensor. And all of these things need to be differentiated, the coefficient function and the two covariant basis vectors. In our case, just the dxi. So this term comes from differentiating, covariantly differentiating the coefficient function, but the covariant derivative of a function is just the ordinary derivative. So that's why we get this. And then we get the covariant derivatives of the covariant basis vectors, of the cotangent space basis vectors, of which there are two in this tensor, because the metric is a 0-2 tensor, and this gives us these two terms. This equation, I'm writing down again and again. The only difference is that I've switched indices. So I've used the cyclic permutation, not even cyclic, it's just the permutation of the indices. So it's really three times the same equation, but with the indices renamed. And then let us add them up in a clever way. Namely, we add the second and the third and subtract the first and take one half of these equations. If we do this, and I don't know who did this first, but I remember reading it first in a little book that Einstein wrote. Einstein wrote a book called Principles of Quantum Principles of Special and General Relativity. Actually, he wrote two, and both are very highly to be recommended. One of them is technical and is for people like yourself who can handle the technical part, and the other one is written for philosophers. And both of them are really, really nice books, among the nicest I've ever seen. Anyway, in the technical book, he goes through exactly this equation, through these calculations. So we have these three equations, which are really just this one. We add them all up, and then we can obtain from that condition that this must be true. Now we are almost there, because remember that the metric is non-degenerate by assumption, which means that as a matrix, it is invertible. So if we now take that equation and just multiply it from the left with the inverse matrix, then we have on the right-hand side just the Christoffel symbol, and on the left-hand side, just metric stuff. And this is what we get, this equation here. It expresses the Christoffel symbol for the so-called Levi-Civita connection, in terms of the metric. So we can now express, given the metric, what the Christoffel symbol is. Again, this is the relationship that is true if we choose as the basis in the tangent and cotangent spaces the basis that comes with the coordinate system. Now, at this point, we are ready to upgrade the math. Been waiting for that for a while, I hope. So, we are now making use of the fact that in our tangent and cotangent spaces, we can choose whatever basis we want. It doesn't have to be the coordinate basis. So let us choose to any arbitrary basis in the tangent space that we may call ER. And the dual basis we will call theta I. It wouldn't even have to be the dual basis to the EI, but it's just convenient to choose this to be the dual basis so that when you evaluate one on the other, you get the Kronecker delta IJ. And they are called frames. So this is one thing we will ourselves to do now, which we will allow ourselves to do. Choose arbitrary bases. Further, we will do at the same time another step. Remember, we covered integration, but I only gave you half the story at the time, because all we could ever integrate with our methods that we covered so far with the integration is functions that were number valued. Because we were always integrating n forms, top forms, and they evaluated into numbers. But you know from other fields in physics, electromagnetism, for example, that sometimes we may want to integrate functions that are not number valued, but vector valued or tensor valued or something like this. How can we do this? from what we've seen so far, it seems impossible, because didn't we argue that the only thing that can ever be integrated is a top form? So if you want to do a three-dimensional integral, you have to integrate a three form. If you want to integrate a one-dimensional integral, you have to integrate a one form, and so on. Now, it turns out that this can be fixed quite easily. Namely, if you have a tensor, an arbitrary tensor, then you can often identify in that tensor a form part. Some part of it may be covariant and antisymmetric. If it is, that's a form. And the rest of the tensor is then the value that it takes. So you can take a tensor, identify covariant antisymmetric parts in it, and if there's, for example, let's say you have a tensor with 27 indices, some of them upper, some of them lower, and there are two lower indices with respect to which our tensor is antisymmetric, then we can say it's a two-form. It's a two-form with respect to those two covariant indices. Now we started out with 27 indices, right? So we have two that we declare to be a two-form now, and then we have 25 indices left over. So what we have is a tensor, no, what we have is a two-form, which is 25, which is rank 25 tensor-valued, right? So it's a two-form, and if you feed it its two tangent vectors to satisfy the two covariant entries, then you're left with a 25 tensor, right? And so you can take any tensor and try to identify covariant antisymmetric parts in it, and that would be a form part, and the rest is then the value that the tensor takes. Sometimes, of course, there may not be any antisymmetric covariant indices to use like that. It may have one covariant index, but one covariant index can't be antisymmetric. Or it may only have two covariant indices, but they're not antisymmetric, they're just symmetric, for example. You can still do it. You just pick one covariant index and declare your tensor to be one form with respect to that. Because one forms are not antisymmetric, they have nothing to antisymmetrize with. It sounds like a cheap trick, but it's super powerful, and it's what you need to be able to integrate over these things as well. Okay, so that's one of the things we will do. So we will allow ourselves to choose any basis we want in tangent and cotangent spaces, decoupled from the choice of coordinate system. And that will have as a crucial implication that when we write down now, after we've made that choice, when we write down a tensor field, it will consist of coefficient functions times basis vectors, as usual, basis vectors in the tangent and cotangent spaces, and those coefficient functions have a special property when you change coordinates. And the property is that they don't care. Okay? Because you change coordinates, but so what? You're not changing bases in your tangent and cotangent spaces, and therefore the coefficients stay the same. Now you can see that they're really scalars, the coefficient functions, because they don't transform at all. All right, so we will do those two things. We will identify parts of tensors as forms, and we will choose the bases arbitrarily. And when we do this, we will obtain new, powerful, simple equations that relate the covariant derivative, the affine connection, the metric, the curvature, and the torsion. So we will still for a little while, allow that the torsion may be non-zero, just because we can take it along, and who knows, maybe torsion will play a role eventually. So what is a frame then? A frame or moving frame is a set of basis vectors for every tangent space. So I should really write here EI of x, because at every point of the manifold, we have to make a choice of basis vectors. And along with that choice of basis vectors, we make the choice of dual bases in the cotangent space just for convenience. So once we've made up our mind about which basis vectors we choose here, we define the dual basis in the cotangent space to be the basis theta that has this evaluation rule against the basis vectors in the tangent space. And the terminology is that this is called the tetrad formalism in four dimensions. That is going back to, I think, the Greek, where tetrad stands for four, is that correct?
Yeah, tetrad is four.
Great. Okay, and in German it is vier. So it's a Greek and a German thing. And bein means leg, so a four-legged thing. A four-legged thing is a basis of four vectors, right? So that's what that is. And if the dimension is not specified, then it is not called the vierbein, because then it shouldn't be four legs, it could be n legs. And the word that's sometimes used is vielbein, where it's not an R but an L, and that's German for many, many legs. Anyway, you just choose basis vectors at every point. Now, what are the coefficients in this case? Remember that when we wrote down coefficients earlier, they were always, coefficient functions of tensors and the affine connection, they were always relative to the coordinate basis. Now, we are no longer doing this, so we define our coefficient functions to be relative to the basis that we choose. So, for example, we have the torsion tensor, is the abstract torsion map. And remember what the torsion map does. It takes two inputs, gives you output, you evaluate that, and this gives you the coefficient functions. And remember that these do not change as you change coordinate system. They only change if you change basis, but the choice of basis is now decoupled from the choice of coordinate system. The same for the curvature tensor's coefficients. They are now decoupled from the choice of coordinate system, and that's what they are. They're all just scalar functions. I mean, the coefficient functions are always scalar functions, but now we see it more clearly. And the same for the metric, and the same for the affine connection. So all of these coefficient functions are now defined relative to our arbitrary choice of bases. Now, as we change coordinate system, we don't have to change the bases. And vice versa. If we do want to change bases, it has nothing to do with changing coordinates. We can change the bases in our tangent spaces even while remaining in the same coordinate system. It just has nothing to do with each other. So let us consider now what happens when we change the bases or the frame. The frame is, a choice of four basis vectors at every tangent space. So let's say we start out with this basis in the cotangent space, and then we change our mind, or more accurately, we change our basis to a new set of basis vectors in the cotangent spaces, and they're simply obtained by some kind of linear transformation that we assume to be invertible, a linear transformation that gets us from these basis vectors to those basis vectors. And notice that we are free to choose a change of basis at every point of the manifold. We can, for example, leave the basis the same, but some patches of the manifold changes in some others, and so on. And since we always want the E and the theta bases to be orthogonal to each other, this induces the way in which the basis of the tangent space has to transform as well. It has to transform with respect to the inverse matrix so that the evaluation always stays the same. Now we do this, the second part of our mathematical upgrade. The first part was choose an arbitrary basis in the tangent and cotangent spaces and allow yourself to change basis whenever you want or not changing it. The second step was that we wanted to upgrade from just having tensors on one hand and differential forms on the other hand, we now want to have also the ability to describe tensor-valued differential forms. So differential forms which, when all of their entries are satisfied, output not a number, but output a tensor. And we said we can do this by taking an ordinary tensor, identifying covariant indices that are anti-symmetric, and then declaring them differential forms. So the definition is that an RS tensor-valued p-form, let's call it phi, is an anti-symmetric p-multilinear mapping at each point of the manifold. So a tensor-valued, an RS tensor-valued p-form, is going to be an object that wants to eat up p tangent vectors, just like any p-form wants to do. Any p-form is p-fold covariant, so it waits for p tangent vectors to evaluate to a number. But these things wait for p tangent vectors to be fed to our tensor-valued p-form, and the output is not a number. The output is an RS tensor. And so such a p-form is then usually written in this way. So these are the coefficients of the p-form. Remember, the output here is r-fold contravariant and s-fold covariant. So if we put r basis vectors in here and s basis vectors in there, then we get coefficients for this tensor. That's what we did here. So we fill in here the r cotangent vectors and basis vectors, and here S tangent basis vectors. And then this output tensor evaluates into a number at each point, or a coefficient function, and these are the coefficient functions. Notice that the form part has been suppressed in here in this way of writing it. Our tensor is also a p-form, but the p-form indices are suppressed, they're not spelled out. So it's a p-form whose value is an RS tensor with these coefficient functions, and the form part could be spelled out, but is traditionally not spelled out. There are two special cases that are already known to us. One special case is that of RS tensors. You see, an RS tensor can always be viewed as an RS tensor-valued zero form, right? Because the zero form doesn't wait for any input. It's just a function. An RS tensor is really an RS tensor-valued function. So that's a special case where this is all there is. These coefficient functions are all there is. And there is no hidden form part that is not spelled out. On the other hand, what's a p-form? A p-form is a 0-0 tensor-valued form. It waits for p tangent vectors to be fed, and then the output will be a function. It's a 0-0 tensor-valued p-form. But as you see here, we can describe arbitrary tensor-valued arbitrary forms. So in particular, let us consider the torsion tensor. Remember, there was the torsion map, which is anti-symmetric. The torsion map takes as input two tangent vectors, and the output is a tangent vector. And so we can now define the torsion's 1-0 tensor value 2 form. This is going to be the torsion 2 form. The output of it is going to be a tangent vector, right? The output of the torsion map is a tangent vector. And the input is two tangent vectors. As any respectable two form will do, it will ask for two tangent vectors. And that is what our torsion two form will do. It will ask for two tangent vectors to be fed. And then the output is not a number, it is the tangent vector that you get by multiplying these coefficients with these basis vectors. And what are you supposed to get? Well, by definition, you have to get this, the output of the torsion map. So The torsion map takes two tangent vectors as input, and the output is another tangent vector. And that's what the same. That's the same thing on the left-hand side. You take two tangent vectors as input, you get a tangent vector as output. It qualifies as a differential form because this is anti-symmetric. So if we choose now a frame, then we can write it in this way. the torsion two-form is a two-form, so it is a linear combination of the basis vectors in the space of two forms. Remember that theta k veg theta l form a basis in the space of two forms. And any two form must be a linear combination of these. So here we have coefficient functions. But there is an extra index I here. And that's the contravariant index. That's because once you satisfy that, once you feed it two tangent vectors, you still are left with that, which you could contract with the EI to get an actual tangent vector. As I wrote it here, it's just the coefficients of it. And a similar thing can be done with the curvature, because the curvature too is anti-symmetric with respect to two arguments. Remember what the torsion meant. The torsion was anti-symmetric in two indices, which we are operating in such a way that if you define the torsion two form is expecting two tangent vectors and outputting one tangent vector. And in practice, you are feeding it two tangent vectors that define a parallelogram, or that want to define a parallelogram. And the output of the torsion map is the vector by which you're missing to close the parallelogram. Right? So you try to do parallelogram, but you don't get quite back to where you started. And a little bit that's missing, that's the output of the torsion map. And for the curvature tensor, if you remember, you also feed it two vectors, two tangent vectors, to define a parallelogram. But then you're left with an object that has two indices, which is actually a little rotation. And it is the rotation that a vector experiences when you parallel transport it around the parallelogram. So the curvature two form is made out of the curvature map. If you remember, the curvature map has also anti-symmetry in here. If you just remember from a little earlier today, we had indices that were anti-symmetric in the Riemann curvature tensor. So the Riemann curvature tensor can be viewed as a 1-1 tensor value two form. So two of the anti-symmetric indices, the third and the fourth in the Riemann curvature tensor, those two can be used to say that this is actually a differential form. And then the first and the second index, the upper and the lower one, leave you with a 1-1 tensor. So you apply two tangent vectors in a way that's anti-symmetric to the curvature map, apply that to a tangent vector, you get a tangent vector, and that's supposed to be the same as what you have here. And so you get the curvature two form. Curvature two form outputting a 1-1 tensor. Given a frame, given our choice of basis, it means that the Riemann curvature tensor can be written as the curvature two form is some coefficients times basis vectors in the space of two forms. And these coefficients are the Riemann curvature tensor. You just have the KL, the third and the fourth index contracted here. Remember, they were anti-symmetric. And these two indices are the 1-1 indices of the value that the differential form takes. Now, we've achieved that both the torsion and the curvature can be written as differential forms, as differential two forms. It would be nice if also the connection could be written as a form, but can it? See, this is not trivial because the Christoffel symbols, and remember what they are, the covariant derivative of a basis vector, and remember that doesn't have to be a basis in the coordinates, it's not a, doesn't have to be a coordinate basis. The covariant derivative of a basis vector in the direction of another basis vector is given by the vector that you get when you contract in this way. Christoffel symbols times that. And remember that these gammas are not tensors to start with. We were on safe ground up to now because we just took a tensor and then said, and an anti-symmetric part of it can be declared to be a form. After all, differential forms are nothing but totally anti-symmetric covariant tensors. And so it was no big deal to just set aside a few of them and call it a differential form. But this thing is not a tensor to start with. And secondly, it's not anti-symmetric in anything either. It's symmetric in those two guys, if there's no torsion. And when there is torsion, it's not even symmetric in these two guys. So what can be done? I mentioned it earlier. When you don't have anything anti-symmetric in your covariant indices, you can still pick one of them, because one forms are not anti-symmetric in anything. And let's see, that actually makes sense here. Because after all, the connection, just like the curvature, just like the torsion, waits for tangent vectors. See, you feed two tangent vectors into the torsion 2 form, and then what it will output is this little deficiency vector by which a parallelogram doesn't close. If you take two tangent vectors and you plug them into the curvature 2 form, these two tangent vectors again describe a parallelogram, and the curvature 2 form tells you the little rotation by which a vector parallel transported along that parallelogram will have undergone while traveling. The connection also waits for a tangent vector, namely the direction vector in which you want to covariant differentiate. If you tell the connection, if you feed it a tangent vector, then it will tell you the little rotation that the vector numerically will experience, I mean, in your choice of basis, in your choice of coordinate system, the affine connection will tell you how the vector's coefficients change as you walk in the direction specified by the tangent vector. So it makes sense to turn the connection into a one form, where we take one of the coefficients here, namely the one that takes as input the tangent vector, that says, okay, I want to go in this direction. And then I'm asking, if I go in that direction, what is the rotation matrix for my tangent vectors that I'm parallel transporting? Okay, so we define the connection one form, which is then called omega ij. So remember, it's omega, it looks very different from gamma, but it's really the same thing. It's just packaged differently. So the connection one form is called omega ij. It has only 2 indices, gamma has 3. What happened? Well, what happened is that we are suppressing the form part of the index, right? Again, as we did before, we have here a one form, which is 1-1 tensor valued. So it's a one form, and then once you feed that form with its tangent vector, you're left with a 1-1 tensor. And it's defined in this way, that the connection one form has these coefficient functions. It's the Christoffel symbol times the theta k, you're contracting these things. So what this is doing is, it says that if you feed it a tangent vector, you get this matrix, and that matrix will tell you how a vector is rotating under parallel transport in the direction of the vector that you fed into here. So what that means is that we can now write the affine connection, the covariant derivative of a tangent vector e in the direction of xi in this way. You take the direction vector, so the direction in which you want to differentiate, and you plug it in your connection one form. You see, it's a one form, so it's waiting for a tangent vector as its input, and then it will evaluate into a 1-1 tensor, that 1-1 tensor. And you can contract that here, and you get the rotation of that vector. Now, what does the connection one form, how does it act for, not for tangent vectors, but for cotangent vectors. As I said earlier, if we take the connection one form and we feed it a direction vector, it tells you how a tangent vector will rotate under infinitesimal parallel transport. But the connection one form also will tell you how a cotangent vector will rotate under parallel transport in the direction of psi. And the proposition is that the covariant derivative of a cotangent vector in the direction of psi is given by this expression here. So we take our connection one form, we feed it the tangent vector, the direction in which we want to covariantly differentiate, we get out this matrix, and now we have to contract, well, with a lower index, and we also acquire a minus sign. Why? Why is it easy to prove? Consider the evaluation of the cotangent basis against the tangent vector space basis. It's just the Kronecker delta. So in particular, these are numbers that are constant. Therefore, the covariant derivative of this entire thing is clearly vanishing. So 0 equal to the covariant derivative of that. But we can also use the fact that the covariant derivative obeys the Leibniz rule. It's a derivation after all. So we can covariantly differentiate this, leaving that the same, plus leaving that the same and covariantly differentiating this. And remember too that the covariant derivative was of course constructed in such a way that the action of the covariant derivative and the contraction of indices commute with each other. Remember, that was part of our construction. So let's apply this. We have the covariant derivative acting on the first factor, carrying forward the second, plus carrying forward the first factor, and covariantly differentiating the second factor. Now, this piece we know. This is the covariant derivative of a tangent vector in the direction of psi. And, well, what we have to do is we have to take psi, plug it into our one form, our connection one form, and we get how it transforms. And that is just what we had a little earlier on the previous slide. Covariant derivative, this covariant derivative is equal to this. Now, this covariant derivative is what we want to know. We don't have that yet. We want to know what the covariant derivative of a cotangent vector is. So that's just carried forward. But you see, we have the 0 equal to this plus that. And therefore, we have that these two terms have to be equal. And so if we now put this term on the left-hand side and make use of the fact that it has to be true for all basis vectors Ej, we find that the covariant derivative of a basis of the basis vector of the cotangent space is given by minus the connection one form contracted in this way. But connection one forms, just so that we don't get too complacent, are not tensorial. They're still not tensorial. Even though we've identified a one-form part in it, which was fairly trivial, it doesn't mean that the rest is tensorial. And just to see that explicitly, let's look at how the connection one-form's coefficient functions transform if we choose a different basis in our tangent and cotangent spaces. Remember, we can do that whether or not we change coordinates. It's a completely decoupled question. So let's say we want to go from this basis in the cotangent space to that basis in the cotangent space related by some function aij of x that we make up arbitrarily. We just want it to be invertible. Other than that, it's fine. So then the claim of this proposition is that the coefficient functions of the connection one form with respect to the new frame are given by this expression here, where we have the old connection one form's coefficient function. I mean, it's still the same connection one form. It's just its old coefficient functions with respect to the old basis. And then you have these matrices A and A inverse here, and you have another part that doesn't even depend on the connection one form. This is very similar to what we saw earlier for the Christoffel symbols. When we transform the Christoffel symbols from one coordinate system to another coordinate system, while the choice of bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces was still tied to the coordinate system. We changed coordinate system. That in itself didn't change the Christoffel symbols. But because we changed the tangent and cotangent spaces, basis vectors, along with the change of coordinates, that meant that the basis vectors changed, that meant that the coefficients changed, and if you remember, we had something like gamma matrix here in the new coordinate system equal to gamma matrix in the old coordinate system, and then we had here Jacobi matrix, because the basis changed according to the Jacobi matrix, and then here we had some other terms that had to do with dx tildes by dx's and so on. And now we see that it really had nothing to do with the change of coordinate. Because here, we are not changing coordinates. We can leave the coordinates the same. We're just changing bases in the tangent spaces and cotangent spaces. This is the origin for this transformation rule. How does this work out? Is this really a one form on the left and on the right? Let's see. On the left, we have a one form, right? It's really a Christoffel symbol with one lower index identified as the index of a one form. On the right-hand side, it's still a one form. But it's multiplied with these change of basis functions, which are just scalar functions, just functions. And so the whole thing is still, these are zero forms, functions. And here we have what? We have functions, but the D of it, D of a function is a one form. So that is a one form, as well as this, as well as that. Okay, let's prove the proposition. Okay, so by definition, the covariant derivative of the new basis vectors is given by that, right? It's minus, and then the new coefficient functions of the connection one form. You know, the barred basis requires a barred coefficient function. But now let's use the Leibniz rule. You see, the theta bar is given by this product here. Basis vector, coefficient function. So we have here basis vector times coefficient function. We apply this covariant derivative to both. And what does that do? Well, we get two terms, one where we covariantly differentiate the A and one where we covariantly differentiate the theta. The first term gives us a dA of theta, of xi, and the second term gives us a carry forward of A and a covariant derivative of theta. By the way, you may wonder, where does this exterior derivative come from? Well, remember that the covariant derivative of a function, of a zero form, the covariant derivative in the direction of a vector field psi of a function, even though this thing has indices, it's just functions, right? The covariant derivative of a function in the direction of a vector is the vector applied to the function. But the vector applied to the function is the same as the d of the function applied to the vector. And that's what I wrote here. It's the d of a applied to the vector. Okay, so then this is being carried forward to here. And this is being carried forward, except that we spelled out what that is. This covariant derivative of theta is given by the connection one form in the old basis. I shouldn't say old coordinate system, because remember, we didn't change the coordinates, just the basis. So this is the covariant derivative, and we can write it in terms of the connection one form with respect to the old basis. And now, in the last step, we are expressing the old basis vectors in terms of the new basis vectors using A inverse, the change of basis matrix inverse. So all of this is carried forward, except that occurrences of theta were replaced by occurrences of A inverse theta bar. A inverse theta bar. And so you see that the omega bar coefficient matrix is expressed in this way down here. The only difference is that we multiply it also with these basis vectors, but it's, since it's supposed to be true. Since this is true for all basis vectors, it's true for the coefficients themselves, and therefore that equation follows. Okay, yet another derivative. Okay, remember two of the derivatives that we studied were the covariant derivative and the exterior derivative. The exterior derivative applied to differential forms. The covariant derivative applied to tensors. Now we have hybrid animals, where the thing is a tensor-valued differential form. So let's come up with a derivative which can be applied to such a hybrid, which does the D action on the form part, and it does the covariant action on the tensor part. This is called the absolute exterior differential, capital D. So the proposition is that the following is well defined. And that for every RS tensor valued P form, there exists a unique RS tensor valued P plus 1 form. So remember, because this is going to be included in here, the degree of the form is going to go up by 1. And that output P plus 1 form, RS tensor valued P plus 1 form, will be called capital D phi. And its components, once we've chosen some basis, are given by this. We can, of course, simply define it this way. We can simply say, yeah, colon equal to, that's the definition. And if you like, that's how you can view it. But of course, it remains to show that this is sensible, that if you change basis, that if you change coordinates, that this is a covariant definition, that it doesn't matter which basis you chose to define this. And the proof is surprisingly tedious, and I'm just pointing to a source where this is done in detail. So the absolute exterior differential D is acting in this way. Remember, this is the coefficient matrix of our RS tensor valued differential form. And in particular, it's a differential form. So the first thing that this does is it takes the exterior derivative of this differential form while leaving the tensor part untouched. And then it will take the tensor part, and every one of the tensor indices gets contracted with the differential, with the connection one form. So it is as if we wanted to covariantly differentiate, because we have that every contravariant index gets contracted with the connection one form. See, it's going to be I1 L, and then it's going to the L going to be here, and then there, and then and so on. It's always with the connection one form. And the covariant indices, as it should be, we derive this, will also be differentiated with respect to the connection one form, but with a minus sign, and the indices contracted differently. So this part is doing covariant differentiation, that is doing exterior differentiation. This D is an antiderivation. It's a little tedious to show that. Antiderivation, if you remember, means that there is going to be a minus sign in the Leibniz rule if the degree of the first of the two differential forms happens to be odd. Let us consider the two special cases. Remember that when we have tensor-valued differential forms, two special cases are that it's entirely a tensor or entirely a differential form. So assume for a moment that we have just an ordinary P form. So it's, in other words, it's a zero-zero tensor-valued P form. In this case, we have that there are no indices here. absolutely no indices because it's a zero, zero tensor valued form. In this case, there is no sum here because there are no indices to contract and we only have the exterior derivative. So for ordinary differential forms, the capital D is just a little d. On the other hand, if we take an ordinary tensor field, so it's a tensor valued zero form, well, in that case, the capital D is just the absolute covariant derivative, where we don't specify the direction in which we covariant differentiate. I leave it to you as an exercise to check that this is so. Notice that then the first term with a little d is still there, but it is the first term of the covariant derivative, the ordinary derivative term. I'm giving you hints here as to how to calculate that. So how are the connection one form, the metric, the curvature and the torsion and the curvature related now? Well, the first proposition is that the compatibility condition that links an affine connection to a metric now takes this form. Remember, it used to be that the covariant derivative of the metric is zero. Now, it's simply the capital D of the metric is zero. And that's because the metric is not a differential form at all. It's just a 0-2 tensor. And therefore, the capital D is just the covariant derivative. So saying that the covariant derivative of G is vanishing, the absolute covariant derivative of G is vanishing, is the same as saying that the capital D on it is vanishing. So here we are viewing the metric as a 0-2 tensor valued zero form. The G is a 0-2 tensor valued zero form, but if we take that D of it, then it becomes a one form. So one of the reasons why we went through all of this acrobatics is that in terms of the curvature 2 form and in terms of the torsion 2 form, the key equations of general relativity take a simpler form, especially when you write them down abstractly. So for example, the torsion can now be written in this way. The torsion is the d of our choice of basis here plus connection one form wedge choice of basis. And that can be even written more simply as the torsion tensor, the torsion two form, being the capital D of our choice of basis here. We wonder what choice of basis is human made, right? So how come that we have such a relation here? We will see later how the information about the shape of the manifold can in fact be encoded in the basis vectors, in the tangent and cotangent spaces. This condition, if you boil it down to things that we've seen before, by choosing a coordinate system, choosing the basis vectors that come with the coordinate system, the dxi and d by dxj, then this equation here, which is also called the first Cartan structure equation, then that equation boils down to something you've seen before, namely the torsion tensor is the anti-symmetric part of the Christoffel symbols. That's what this equation becomes if you just spell it out. So it relates the Christoffel symbols to the torsion. You can view this as the definition of the torsion. Similarly here, if we take the d of the connection one form plus connection one form wedge connection one form, we get a two form, right? Because this starts out as one form, this whole thing is a two form, that's a two form, of course. So the whole thing is a two form, which we call omega, or also the curvature two form. You can view this as the definition of the curvature two form, because if you choose coordinate system and you choose the bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces that come along with that coordinate system, then this equation becomes that equation that we had earlier. The Riemann curvature tensor is given, can be given explicitly in terms of the Christoffel symbol. No, I think we did we have that earlier? I don't remember whether we had it already. But in any case, the Riemann curvature tensor can be expressed in terms of Christoffel symbols. But this is, of course, much more general, because we don't have to choose those bases. I think we don't really have the time to prove this part. So I wanted to show you the proof of the that this really gives us the, that this is really what we defined earlier as the curvature 2 form. Yeah. Well, actually, I think maybe we can do it. Should we do it or move on? I think we're all a little tired, perhaps. okay, let's... sorry, here we are. Okay. So what is then the use of the Cartan structure equations, which, if you remember, are simply the definition of the torsion and the definition of the curvature in terms of the connection 1 form. Right? Just illustrate it again over here. Assume you have made your choice of bases. Assume you've written down the connection 1 form. That was your choice. Then you can calculate what the torsion is. You can calculate what the Riemann curvature tensor is. Then remember, we already had two ominous equations there, the so-called Bianchi identities. And the Bianchi identities, now with these upgraded mathematical tools, can be written in this form. The first Bianchi identity is that the capital D differential operator acting on the torsion gives you the curvature 2 form, veg your choice of frame. It may not be transparent very much, but it's very simple. And that's what makes it useful. And the capital D of the curvature 2 form is always vanishing. So in particular, when we use the connection that comes with the metric, the unique connection that comes with the metric that does not have torsion, then the torsion 2 form will vanish, and we have two Bianchi identities that take now this form. The curvature 2 form veg your choice of bases equal to 0, and the capital D operator, differential operator on the omega, is vanishing. It's a little bit like generalizing that the covariant derivative of the metric is vanishing. So here we have that the generalized derivative of the curvature is vanishing. Now, at the beginning of this lecture today, we calculated the Christoffel symbols as a function of the metric. We said if we describe the shape of a manifold using the metric, we should be able to describe it also through Christoffel symbols. And we found uniquely how to do that. But remember too that at the time, we were still using the basis vectors that came with the choice of coordinate system. Now we are more free, but it comes with a price. We get a tremendous benefit from being able to choose the basis vectors whichever we want, whichever way we want, but here's a price to pay. If we now calculate the Christoffel symbols with our arbitrary choice of basis vectors, as we can do using the Cartan structure equations, then we obtain that the Christoffel symbols are given by these expressions here, where the where there are where coefficient matrices C are arising here and there that are new. You see, this first line was absent in our calculations earlier in this lecture. There was only the second line. And these coefficients were absent. What are these coefficients? I think I mentioned it earlier briefly, but maybe I skipped over it. So when we make a choice of bases, theta I, then we can calculate what the D is of these basis vectors. Ordinarily, that would be a futile exercise, because if we choose, as one usually does, the basis that comes along with the coordinate system, then the theta I would be the dxi. If we take the D of those, it's vanishing. So there's no information in calculating what the D of those basis vectors is. But generically, the theta could be any basis in the tangent spaces. And so taking the D of it is non-trivial. It's going to be some linear combination of the basis vectors in the space of two forms, because the theta is one form, the D of it is a two form. So the whole thing, the left-hand side, must be a linear combination of these basis vectors. And these coefficient matrices describe how far this is away from being a coordinate basis. So this matrix goes in here. And clearly, if we choose the coordinate basis, the C's will be vanishing, because D of D is zero. And so the entire first line vanishes. And in this case, we also find that the Riemann curvature tensor is no longer expressed in the way that it used to be expressed when we used the coordinate basis. Namely, it was be this, this term, that term, and that term. No, now, with respect to a generic basis, we also get an extra term here that is proportional to this coefficient matrix C. So you may wonder, oh, this coefficient matrix C, that's a headache. If only we didn't have that. Maybe it wasn't so bad to use the basis that comes with a coordinate system. The interesting thing is that basically all of the information about gravitation can be encoded in those coefficients. For example, and we will get to this later on, we may want to choose our tangent vectors, bases. We may want to choose our thetas and our E bases in such a way that the metric is always, at every point of the manifold, the metric is simply the eta mu nu of Minkowski space. We can do that. You can always choose the basis at every point in the manifold that says simultaneously the metric always takes this trivial form. And then you may wonder, well, where's the information then? It used to be that the metric tensor g mu nu of x encoded everything about the manifold for us. Somehow it was magically encoded in the matrix elements of the G mu nu of x. Well, but remember, that was so because we tied the choice of basis to the choice of coordinate system, and then the metric somehow ended up encoding all that information. But a canonical choice of basis is the choice of basis where the metric tensor is simply eta mu nu everywhere simultaneously. And then where does the physical information sit? If it's no longer in the metric, it's basically sitting in these guys. And so we will see more about them later on. Okay, any questions? Yes?
Say I have Einstein field equations, right? Einstein field equations is a symmetric equations, correct? Because the indices are all symmetric. But if I convert into compound formalism, right, then I have all the important quantities anti-symmetric. So does it mean that I solve less equations?
Well, that would be beautiful, yes. No, it turns out that the Einstein field equations will be equations for differential forms, but differential one form. So basically, there will be a one form. I mean, it's you're right. It's basically symmetric, covariant symmetric two tensor. And as it will happen, it will turn out that one of those two covariant indices will be declared a one form, and the other one is still tensorial. And so that is what naturally comes out. But as you can see, this doesn't really change anything as when it comes to the complexity of actually solving the differential equation.
So there's still that piece that you can't really make anti-symmetric in Einstein field equation.
No. Like, okay. No, it's still symmetric. And so, for example, the energy momentum tensor is symmetric, but you can turn it into a 0-1 tensor valued one form by just saying one of the two indices is a one form. And the same will happen with the Einstein tensor. So the simplification is not in that, it's elsewhere.
There's another question. For your tetra, right, do you restrict them to be like, in the sense that they must be like one time like three space, like, or it works even if I choose all tetras, you know?
Well, you can't have it invertible then. So you want that the, let's say you start out with some basis, and then you start out with some basis, and then you want to change basis. Let's say you start with a coordinate basis, and you want to change to a basis in which you have four space-like vectors as the basis vectors, and they won't be spanning, so they don't span the entire space then.
But what if I use like all tetras, they are like null vectors, like I use null coordinates instead?
I don't think you can use four null coordinates. You mean you use four null vectors?
Like in the case of like the Eddington Filkenstein coordinates, right? I eliminate one coordinates into a null coordinates. Would that still work?
Like because one of them, yes. Yes, you can do that. Yeah, one of your basis vectors can be null if you want.
But I can't make all of.
No both. Maybe two. Not sure. But one you can.
So technically, like say NP formalism, right? The Neumann-Penrose, the null tetrad is not the same as this tetrad.
I don't think so. Any further questions? Yes.
Can you go back one page to the this page, just this page. Stay here.
This page. Okay.
Yeah. So for the second Bianchi identity, with or and without the Tauch torsion, they're the same. Like it seems like. With like there's something missing here, some information missing here, because the second Bianchi identity doesn't change with or without the torsion, right? Because the first Bianchi you have the like right side. Not
I think you're right. I have to check that.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. I think I assumed that the torsion is vanishing on the
okay.
Second equation. That's right.
Okay.
Good point, I'll check that. Yes, that's right. The second Bianchi identity in the form that we originally had derived, it had the torsion.
Right.
But this torsion should be encoded in the absolute exterior derivative. Because when you reduce it to, say, when it reduces to covariant derivative when you apply it to general tensors, then your covariant derivative has torsion information, right?
It could be, yes. It could be that it's in there. That's right. I'd be surprised, though.
Yeah, like, in my point of view, if that's the case, then there's something, like, some information missing here, because...
No. But you see, what he's saying is that there is, in principle, a term on the right-hand side,
right.
But because of the way that the D is defined...
Oh, so
it's actually part of the left-hand side.
So D is absorbing the right-hand side.
Yes, so that it's still the same form whether or not there is torsion. It's conceivable, but...
because if you...
See, most people don't work with torsion. I'm just trying to carry it along as far as possible. I may have dropped it too early.
No, I think it should still be inside the exterior derivative because in the case where you apply D on a normal tensor field, ordinary tensor fields, it will just be a covariant derivative. And covariant derivative is different for torsion-free connection and a torsion,
mm-hmm.
The ones with connection, and the one with torsion, I think.
Yeah, I mean, what this says is that it could be true. It doesn't guarantee that it is working this way. Okay, so that's it for today. We have another class tomorrow. And then tomorrow night I'll fly to England. I'll come back on Wednesday night. So, but that doesn't mean we won't have a, it doesn't mean that we will not have a class on Tuesday. But instead, my student Jason over here will have the honor of teaching the Tuesday class. He took the course 2 years ago. So he's an expert already. So he will teach the class on Tuesday, and we have one more tomorrow, then Jason, and then me again on next week Friday. Okay.